I'm in the limelight cause I rhyme tight. Time to get paid, blow up like the World Trade. Born sinner, the opposite of a winner. Remember when I used to eat sardines for dinner? Piece to Raw G, Brucey B, Kid Capri. Funk Master Flex, Love Bug Star Ski. I'm blowing up like you thought I would.
And now we're about to have a conversation with D. Watkins, who's been on this program many, many times before, talking about many things. And all the writing he's been doing. Of course, he writes for Salon.com and is in the verge of, in the middle of his novel and more that's coming up, and going to be one of America's great writers, one of our great writers right now. And tomorrow is, and welcome, good to have you back, D. Always good to have you in the studio, brother.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And tomorrow is the anniversary of the passing of the great Claude McKay. Festus Claudius McKay, the Jamaican-American poet who was a deep part of the Harlem Renaissance and the revolutionary movement in this country, and more. And it turns out that D is in love with his work. And who knew? I know now.
Huge.
Tell me about that, man. Tell me how you discovered Claude McKay.
Huge Claude McKay fan. So I discovered Claude McKay while having a drink in MK Asante's studio. Cullen from Red Emma's was like, "Hey, you ever read Claude McKay?"
That's
and I was
funny.
Like, and I said, "Nah, I never read Claude McKay." And he was like, "You should read Claude McKay." So I said, "Okay, cool." He said, "Yeah, come by my store and buy the book." You know,
he was going to give you the book. Come by and buy the book.
You know, it was one of the best things I ever bought. So you know, I went through right home to Harlem, and now, you know, maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, that same book. I still have it, and it's tatted up. There's like notes and lines and everything like
that. He's
all
written
over
so much, but you latched onto that book.
Yeah, because can I read this passage?
You can read whatever you want, okay. Man. That's why you're here.
"Oh, to be in Harlem again after 2 years away. The deep dyed color, the thickness, the closeness of it, the noises of Harlem, the sugared laughter, the honey talk on its streets. And all night long, ragtime blues playing somewhere, singing somewhere, dancing somewhere. Oh, the contagious fever of Harlem, burning everywhere in dark-eyed Harlem, burning now in Jake's sweet blood." So in this book, you know, one of the major things I learned from it, and I think any person who wants to be a writer or a creative writer can learn, is just how to capture the energy of a place that you love.
Mm-hmm.
How to show like that energy and that color and that beauty and that love. You know, it's like Jake, the main guy in the book, is, you know, he's away working on a ship, and you know, it's all about his big return to Harlem. And it's kind of like, you know, how I feel when I go to, you know, some of these different places and return to Baltimore. Like, it's a beauty that I see in my city that a lot of people don't see. But then sometimes I can write about it and show that beauty with, you know, and I try to write about it with the same energy and love that Claude McKay writes about it with.
It's so funny. That book, I think of all the books he wrote and that, you know, all the other kind of great things he's written, the poetry he did in the Jamaican patois, mm-hmm. the banjo, Banana Bottom, all the other kind of novels and stuff he's written, his pieces. And it's interesting, this particular novel you like, I don't know if you know this story or not, but it's interesting, that W.E.B. Du Bois, you know about this?
No,
right,
I don't.
W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, the Talented Tenth, and the a book that really, an author that really affected Claude McKay and when he first went to college in America from Jamaica. So he really looked to Du Bois in his thinking. Du Bois hated this book. Du Bois said, and it's a quote from Du Bois. Let me see if I can find this quote. I was looking it up this morning. Du Bois said that his images in this book fed the prurient demands of white readers and publishers and looking for portrayals of black licentiousness. And he wrote, "Home to Harlem, for the most part, nauseates me, and after the dirtier parts of its filth, I feel distinctly like taking a bath." So I was thinking about, because I've not read this book in a long time, but I read
mm-hmm.
it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I started thinking about, Du Bois, who McKay loved, hated this particular book, which McKay liked, because McKay was coming back to Harlem to write a book about the streets and what he thought the common people were about. And I felt like this was like a kind of deep chasm of class. You know what I'm saying? I mean, a lot of times upper classes can look down upon the life of
right
way folks live who live right in the community.
Du Bois couldn't write this book.
No, boys could not write.
The boys couldn't write this book. And, you know, with all due respect.
But that's interesting, though, that split.
You know, with all due respect, I found so much value in, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, just, you know, as a person, a revolutionary intellect in general.
Right, right.
But I go through the same thing today. A lot of people who are, like, you know, high-ranking intellects, they kind of look at me the same way. My story of redemption, some of the things I find value in are just not important to them. You know, like, I spoke at a class in another professor's class at Coppin after Too Poor for Pop Culture came out.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, some of the students who were, like, who didn't really understand a lot of things, all the different layers of black culture, asked me. And they said, well, you know, you went to Johns Hopkins University. Why are you playing cards in housing projects? Going to Johns Hopkins University doesn't make you exempt from playing cards in a housing project. It doesn't. It also doesn't guarantee you a job at Coppin State University, who has people who don't see value and people who have stories to tell like me. So it doesn't surprise me that an intellect like W.E.B. Du Bois wouldn't see a lot of value in a book like this, because you know, McKay was dealing with the streets, and he wasn't just dealing with, like, you know, street things. He was also dealing with all of the racism and the systemic racism that surrounded the journey of young black people trying to navigate in this world. And just because it's hurtful and it's painful and it's frustrating and it's hard, he still found fun and energy and laughter and excitement and the beauty. It's a beauty in it. But everyone can't see it, and everyone's definitely not going to appreciate it. The same way a lot of people who come from where I come from would, you know, not see a whole lot of value and interest in some of the big intellectual things that you know, Du Bois would lecture at, or that people would talk to, because they feel like these are people who are not addressing our issues on a direct level. They use so many levels away, and we can't even comprehend your 10 syllable words. So you'll never help us. So it's like, I understand, you know, why he wouldn't like it. And I think that's a problem that exists within academia today. It's difficult because we need people who are at these big institutions to understand the energy and the love and the survival skills and the coping mechanisms that come with being from the streets. But then we also need street people to understand how to build that knowledge, how to right. reinvest and change your community with that knowledge, or how to take that knowledge and make it worth something.
No, right. No, exactly. I mean, I was when I raised that issue, I was raising it because I found the contradictions there and the dichotomy between the mm-hmm. two men really, really interesting. That you know, after McKay read Souls of Black Folks when we went to Tuskegee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It just blew him away. The book grabbed him and taught him so much that, you know, it set him on a life path in many ways.
That's the beauty about education. It's like, you know, I mean, there's some organizers out there who probably learned a lot from watching Adolf Hitler. You know,
right?
You know what I mean? Like, you know, you might not be able to speak the language or understand what the heck he's talking about, but when you look at them YouTube videos of him, I'm shouting. You know, he's organizing all of these people without Twitter, without Facebook, without anything. He's organizing all of these people, and they are, you know, doing exactly what he wants them to do. And you know, somebody's learning from that. So I definitely. You know, I know it was probably a tough blow for Claude McKay, but I mean, you know, same with J. Cole, you know, he made a song saying he let Nas down. You know.
So how does his writing? What else you read by McKay?
I read a bunch of his poems, but of everything that I've read, this is like, you know, I don't have any go to poems or any go to like collections of poetry. That really, really hit me like
this
book.
But this one really hit you. Now, why did that book hit you so hard?
Because when I read this book, and you know, and when I was thinking about the way Jake walks through Harlem, I saw myself walking down Miami Street.
I was about to ask.
Walking through Old Town Mall, and just the energy, like it's a feeling that is kind of it's almost kind of hard to explain. But when you know it, you know it. You know, when you know it, you know it. When you know you walk down a block and you know everyone in that neighborhood. And you know everyone in that community. And, you know where the girls are. You know where they're going to party at. You know what they want you to wear. You know what type. Like, when you have a hold on a community and it's your place and it's your kingdom, you know, in the midst of all these other racist things that are going on and trying to oppress you every day, you have this place that's home, and it's your home, and it's your social fabric, and it's what you believe in. And, you know, he captured it in this book. And that's why I said it's a feeling that, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois probably wasn't going to walk through a dense black, you know, population, a neighborhood, this projects and, you know, all of these things and get that love. You know, it's a love that a lot of people don't understand.
I mean, it's like, you know, this particular book, Home to Harlem, which I think is a great book. And I think it'd be fun to have people read this book and kind of really talk about what he did here. I mean, he, you know, won a major award. I forget what it was called. Some gold prize for literature. Harman, I think, was the name of the prize he won for this book. And but this book affected the writing of a lot of people.
Me? No right? doubt. But a lot of people, right?
I mean, because it had this effect on black intellectuals because of his depiction of street life. It was like his coming back from Russia and these revolutionary movements, and he had to go back into the street to kind of think and justify all the things he was thinking about where our politics and our social life were at the moment. You know, it was profound for him too, I think.
People don't really understand, you know, especially like when you become so when you reach a certain level of success, it's very, very, very easy for you to become desensitized to a lot of issues that happen to you in your origin.
Right.
It takes a lot,
right.
You know, it takes a very extremely strong and connected person to be able to remember where they come from and the issues that affect the people in the neighborhoods where they come from. So, you know, again, like I don't expect I wouldn't expect a lot of intellects to like it's kind of the same argument with so many people who people in academia who have major issues with hip hop. You know, all they do is cuss and make noise. That's not true. You know, like the poeticism is crazy, but you know, you take a person who hears two or three mainstream songs and use it to judge a whole genre. And right. It happens all of the time. Like, I've heard so many older people say, especially in academia, I just can't get past the profanity. But you're like you're a paid thinker. You're a person who gets paid to think.
Get past it, right?
You can't, and then I also understand that, you know, tradition can be divisive. You know, there's something inside of you that says using curse words is wrong.
Right.
So the minute you hear them, you cringe. And to me, I don't think you can really, you know, I mean, and I think about all types of issues. Like I think about what goes through the head of a Ku Klux Klan member. I think about what George Bush, you know, with his thought. Like I think about, you know, despite my differences with all of these different people, I always think about, you know, well, I wonder how would you see this situation? How would you assess this situation? How would you, you know, how would they feel if they were forced to live amongst, you know, in East Baltimore, in a neighborhood, anywhere in East Baltimore? How would, you know, I try to imagine things from different perspectives, and I listen to them and I engage them and I pay them that respect. And, you know, I feel like there's a big disservice being done when people who when our paid intellects can't see that. You know, I've done a whole lot of positive things on at Coppin State University and off campus too. Things that have gotten a lot of young people excited yeah. about reading and writing and telling their own personal stories. One of the PR people was trying to hook me up with the president for a long time. And he never, ever, ever responded until I wrote the essay F the National Anthem, because people from other places were emailing him, you know, because he didn't really understand why a person would write something like that. But if you read the essay, you would probably understand.
Which president?
Whoever is the president of Coppin now.
Coppin,
I don't know his name.
Right.
But whoever the president is now took serious issue with that. So, you know, it's been a history of the disconnect between young people who really want to make change and older people who are more bottled down with tradition and not really interested in seeing real changes being made.
It you know, this is when you think about McKay at this point in his life and what he wrote, and I'm thinking about where you are at your point in your life. He was older, obviously, when he wrote this than when you're writing now. I guess McKay must have been – what? It must have been 40-something.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know.
Yeah, because he was born, I think, in 1880. When was he born? 1889. He's born in 1889, so this was written mm-hmm. like in 1928.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also wrote this at kind of the height of his revolutionary thinking. He started writing these other books about, like, books like Banjo and the Banana Plantation. What was it called? Banana Bottom, you know, which was people trying to figure out their ways to get through white society and keep your identity and your culture. And he really was into a very deep place during the 20s and 30s, writing these books about life from how he saw it, you know, deeply the key political perspective.
The key thing you just said, how to get through these societies but maintain your culture.
Right.
You know? How do you get through these societies and maintain your culture? It's like it's almost like a double-edged sword, you know, because when you reach these levels, not only does your exposure change, you know, the things you're exposed to, you know, they automatically change you, but at the same time, you have so many different people who are trying to strip you of who you are. So that they can use you for what they want to use you for. And you're not really having the same type of time to be able to build with the people, you know, where you come from. You get caught up in this, you get caught up in this dangerous web.
Now he was,
but if he wrote this book at this point in his career, it gives me, I have even more respect for him.
Yeah. It was a very special point for him, I think, you know, and later he became, I think, Michael Manley, the Prime Minister of Jamaica, made him the poet of Jamaica, Jamaica's national poet for life, forever. He was already dead, but it was in 77. I mean, he was, you know, he had a very interesting life. I mean, cause he was always a lifelong revolutionary. And then in the 40s, he kind of, something happened. I don't know. I haven't read his biography enough to know what happened, but he switched and became a Catholic after he'd been an atheist most of his life. And then he kind of faded away and he passed away from a heart attack. But his earlier career was just powerful. I mean, just powerful. I read, there was a book he wrote near the end of his life, which I liked too. It was called My Green Hills of Jamaica, when he started writing more about his old home country again. Mm-hmm. But he was just had this broad swath of stuff that he wrote. So do you have another piece in that book you'd like to read? Is another part, a passage you want to jump up and share with us that you really hits you?
Yeah, there's like a really, 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 really funny piece of dialect. It's like,
go ahead.
The first woman that he meets after he gets cleaned up and he's out
no
of the
curse
town.
Words, though, right? We
no,
can't. Right?
No curse words. If it is a curse
it's
word,
it's an ancient one.
Yeah,
it's old, it's one archaic.
Yeah, when I was a kid, my grandma used to always she used to tell us that we'd get in trouble if we said the word lie. I never understood that. the worst thing you could do is call somebody a liar. So, of course, every chance I got. And you know that preacher's a liar. So he meets this woman, and she says, "How much is it going to be, Daddy?" She demanded. "How much? How much? 5. She says, "Oh, no, Daddy, 10. She shook her head. 20, sweetie? He said gallantly. "Daddy," she answered, "I wants 50. "Good," he agreed. He was satisfied. She was responsive. She was beautiful. He loved the curious color on her cheek. You know, so it's like, it's this passage, and then there's another passage where he talks about, like, the difference in price before he went away. And when he came back from not only to spend a night with a woman like her, but to also buy, like, a cocktail on a train, you know, I think the price doubled. So, he's talking about those issues and just the things that you notice when you go away from a place that you love and come back. Everything's different. You got people coming back from, you know, all these that military service or people coming out of prison. And, you know, burger used to be, like, you know, a couple of dollars. I don't know how much Shake Shack is. You know,
right?
You
right.
know, but it's like, you know, but it's like all of these different things. Just, you know, the buildings look, the stuff you remember that's still there, the stuff you love that's gone away, and just the whole theme tied into that whole excitement of I'm back. You know, so that's why this book is important to me. Like, I think even some of the more complex things are good, but I'm really, 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 really in love with those simple things because they're the things that, like, I always, like, try to aim for, or what I've been trying to aim for with some of the new things that I've been working on. Just the simple things that, like, no one else would notice, but they appreciate it at really high levels. I think comedians are great at that, too.
They are good. They are good at that. They are good at that. Well, I mean, could you do what you do and what Claude McKay did, or what any good writer and author does, because you have to be an observer. You have to watch what's happening around you and absorb it and be able to kind of translate it into words, which is, that's the trick of a good author, a good writer. You got another piece you're getting ready to read? Is that what you're looking at?
Oh, no, no. I was, no. I was listening. But, yeah, you got to and I think sometimes, too, it's like, you know, when you try, you'll never find it. It just has to come out right. natural, and you only get those experiences by living life.
Did you ever teach this book?
I taught it in my English 102 class, I think, like, my first semester or my second semester when I was working at Coppin. I taught it in my 102 class, and yeah, some students liked it. I gave them like a weird mix. I gave them some of the books that the school had recommended, but then I also gave them this, and then I gave them Fight Club. And, you know, they were grossed out by Fight Club. But again, that exposure and that way of thinking, and I saw changes in their writing from after reading this to like after reading Fight Club. So you know, all of these things are important. I think it's really, really good to just. Mandatory. Once you become a reader, you have to just diversify. What you're taking in.
Right. Oh, no, you do. You do. I think this is it's interesting you picked this book. I wasn't sure when they said Dean wants to come in and talk about Claude McKay. I said, oh, cool.
Yeah. No, you always got to pay respect to the people that paved the way. Like, it's important to acknowledge all of the ancestors living in past, you know.
No. He, I think... People like me hear that name and go, I know that name, but don't know much about his work in this period of time. They don't read him very much. He's not read in that same way. But I'm so glad you brought this. I'm so glad this is the book you brought in. It is also my favorite book that he wrote.
He's more known as a poet,
right?
You know, for the most part, they always talk about his poetry. They don't really talk about.
But you brought us home to Harlem.
Yeah,
1928.
No doubt.
So that's what we were doing here with our dear friend, Dee Watkins, who has been a guest on the show many times and joining us here to talk about his passion for Claude McKay and how the book Home to Harlem has affected him, one of our great poetic and fictional influences on this culture and more. And we lost Claude McKay on this day, May 22nd, 1948, to a heart attack. And Dee Watkins, thank you so much for coming in and bringing this story to us.
Thank you for shedding light on everyone, man. We need it.
Good to have you here. So, on the way to break, we're hearing Hypnotized by Notorious B.I.G., born on this day in 1972. Tim's for my hooligans in Brooklyn. That's dead right. If they fried Biggie there at night. Papa been fooled since days of under rules. Never lose, never choose to. Bruise, cruise, who? Do something to us. Talk, go through us. Girls want to us, wanna do us. Who us? Yeah, Papa and Pop. Close like Starsky and Hutch. Stick to clutch. Yeah, I squeeze three at your cherry M3. Bang every MC easily. Take that. Easily. Huh? Recently, frontin' ain't saying nothing, so I just speak my peace. Keep my peace, Cubans with the Jesus peace. With my peace, asking who wants.